Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm Samantha Lam, one of the hosts of the channel. And today we are going to be talking to Aaron Hill Doral about his new book, Corn Crusade, Khrushchev's Farming Revolution and the Post-Stalin Soviet Union. So Aaron, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
First off, thanks for the introduction. I am an independent scholar, for want of a better term. I teach occasional courses at Curry College in Milton, Massachusetts, and otherwise do freelance editing, translating, dabble in local politics here in my adopted home state of Rhode Island.
So what got you interested in the topic of Khrushchev and corn growing?
On some basic personal level, it comes from growing up in the Midwest. I lived, quote unquote, in town, but I was, probably 300 yards from the nearest cornfield. So it was always there. And then, as I was in undergraduate, I got interested in Soviet history and started reading about the Khrushchev years. And it was always that the corn campaign was mentioned, but usually as kind of a punchline. It was there for comic relief. Hey, get a load of this, isn't it weird? But I always noticed it because it was something that kind of spoke to my experience. And then when I got to graduate school, it took me a couple of years. I wrote my MA on a different topic. And as I turned to searching for something for my dissertation that would be the thing I was going to spend the next 5, 6, 7 years on, it really jumped out. It fairly quickly became clear that it was the topic was kind of a gold mine and would allow me to speak to a whole range of really interesting issues about the Khrushchev years.
So most historians, like you said, treat it as a sort of a punchline or a quixotic failure, which demonstrates sort of the ridiculousness and fundamental flaws of the Soviet command economy. How is your approach different?
In a way, it's the key is that by taking something that worked more or less, in its own kind of problematic terms elsewhere, this idea of corn as part of a broader program of industrial agriculture, and that ties into this broader idea of the Green Revolution. These are kind of interrelated but somewhat distinct phenomena. And then seeing how they, worked in the Soviet Union or didn't work. Because it's not that this was some kind of resounding success and we just don't know it. It did perform far less well than Khrushchev hoped and expected, but that by looking closely at how it worked, we can really see how those flaws worked on a kind of day-to-day level, getting into the nitty-gritty of the functioning of the Soviet agricultural economy. And the idea is ultimately that it was not ridiculous or entirely workable, but was constrained by this, you know, cumbersome, extremely difficult to reform system. That the system really wasn't a command economy per se, because Khrushchev could enact formal policies all he wanted, but the actual practices on the ground might change very little or might actually contradict those policies. And yet, by the same token, Khrushchev achieved a fair amount, just not all that he hoped. You know, that by 1964, things look quite different than they did 10 years prior at the, you know, at the end of the Stalin era, in terms of the kolkhozes especially, in terms of administration, planning, wages, the crops they were growing, the technology they were using, a whole lot. They're still not in great shape, but they're certainly better off than they were. And I think this kind of speaks to kind of a bigger problem of how historians and scholars more generally have understood the Khrushchev years, and that idea of, hey, isn't this a weird thing that shows the ridiculousness of Khrushchev's policies, has then shaped the way we've understood Khrushchev. We have seen him as this kind of irrational, erratic, idiosyncratic figure, and he certainly had those elements. But as historians have really delved into the archives of the past 15 years or so, really seen the logics behind his policies in agriculture in this case, but more.
Well, I'm in the Stalin period myself with my research, but I have to say there is a lot of, I think, old Cold War baggage about sort of the brokenness or hilariousness or ridiculousness of the Soviet system in general. And this sort of idea of it being a top-down centralized command economy, even under Stalin, is absolutely not true. I mean, I study collective farms and they give orders and the people in the collective farm are like, nope, we don't think so. We're going to either do something completely different or just ignore you and keep doing what we've always been doing.
We're going to tell you we did it and then do whatever we decide is best. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, it's Cold War baggage. You know, certainly there have been lots of people back to, Sheila Fitzpatrick 20 or 30 years ago saying that so much of the Cold War scholarship kind of grabbed this self-image of the party as this kind of top-down, very ordered and disciplined hierarchy, and just kind of flipped it. And said, well, this is instead of a positive, it's a negative, without actually sort of taking apart the ways in which it doesn't really describe the way things work.
So back on Khrushchev, why was he so dedicated to corn in particular? I mean, that's not a crop that grows particularly well in most of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that contributed to this. One thing is worth saying that this is idiosyncratically Khrushchev. If Malenkov or whoever had been in charge of agriculture, they probably would have gone for some kind of industrial farming approach. But to concentrate on corn to the degree they did was very much a choice by Khrushchev. And part of that is global in nature, in that, he's getting reports from experts about how corn works in the United States. And increasingly how in the post-war era, corn is being increasingly used in parts of Europe as well to improve agricultural production and productivity, and especially to make things like meat and milk cheaper than they would have been before. But then there's also an element of Khrushchev's own personal experience. He writes in his memoirs about having encountered it, as a kid growing up in Kursk Oblast and other points, but especially his experience in Ukraine after the war. It was known in Ukraine and surrounding regions, at least back to the 19th century and probably quite a bit further. But there are, he tells a story on a number of occasions of, he interpreted that there was a severe crop failure in the works in 1949, close on the heels of the famine of 46 and 47, and that one of the ways that they averted it was by going back and planting a bunch of the winter crops that had been killed by bad weather with corn, and that helped them survive. And so he kind of credits corn as this sort of new thing that can really, you know, make a difference. So it is both his personal experience and these kind of messages that he's getting about the way that corn is you know, making a change across the world, especially in the U.S.
What I thought was really interesting is your focus on how corn leads to increased standards of living, because most people tend to think of corn and his corn crusade as like people eating actual corn, like corn on the cob or maybe, you know, canned corn or something. But that's not really the goal, is it?
Not at all. You know, there are sort of trial programs to encourage what I kind of call convenience food. So they buy some machinery, and I think in the UK at one point, and start producing corn flakes. But I did the math at one point, and it worked out to like a half a bowl of corn flakes per person per year, if they had actually produced everything, and this would have been in the early 60s, that they said they were going to, and they didn't. And they tried to get people to, you know, they introduced popcorn, for example, but these are tiny minorities. The vast majority of what they're producing is meant to be fed to livestock to make up for the fact that the Soviet diet, as it emerges into the post-war period, is, you know, the stereotype is, of course, it has everything you want as long as what you want is, you know, potatoes and cabbage, and add, you know, healthy doses of meat and milk products and cheese and all of these kinds of things and eggs and stuff that most people had to go to peasant markets to buy or just simply couldn't afford.
And does he borrow this model of basically feedlotting animals from the Americans?
Yeah, that's the kind of goal or the direction that American farmers are moving at that time. And he sends experts and eventually in 59 goes to see for himself how they're doing this. And that's ultimately the goal. Now, the actual practices often leave quite a bit to be desired, but the goal is essentially to create something that looks not unlike kind of the American Corn Belt, where, you know, farmers raise corn and it is immediately, you know, you immediately turn it around and turn it into, you know, beef and pork. And, you know, those things are, you know, the post-war period is a in the United States is a time when productivity is rising rapidly, and a lot of that productivity goes into making those foods cheaper and more affordable for, you know, your average working person. And crucial, they're very aware of this and wanting to try to kind of capture some of that.
You also talk about Khrushchev emphasizing corn as a way to compete with American influence on a global scale, particularly in what we would now call either the developing world or the third world. How was this supposed to work?
So corn is certainly a component. And again, I kind of move from in different kind of registers. You know, corn is a component of this kind of industrial ideal of industrial agriculture, and that is coming very much from American sources, which are admittedly transplanted into the Soviet Union at a pretty early stage, you know, fairly soon after the revolution. And so there, this is sort of a renewed injection of an idea that is already there. And basically, you know, looking at the way they understand how agriculture in the U.S. works, they're seeing it very much in this kind of framework of, you know, sort of cutthroat capitalism and monopolies, and, you know, this idea that the the average kind of family farmer is going to be increasingly squeezed out by larger and larger and larger capital intensive capitalist enterprises. And in a way, they're kind of right. This is the process that's occurring. You know, it goes back to well before World War II, but peaks in things like, you know, I'm a little bit too young to really remember things like Farm Aid when they were new. This idea that there's a crisis in the 80s of the family farm in the U.S. Is something that's very much part of the same story. And basically what they're doing is trying to take the technologies and practices and kind of graft them onto a collective model of agriculture and then export that to places like India to say, basically, we can provide similar rises in productivity, but we will provide you a more egalitarian sort of version of agrarian development without, kicking large numbers of people out off their land and driving them into cities to make up the urban poor and, you know, bankrupting anyone who fails to keep up in this kind of cutthroat competition model. As I document in that chapter two of the book, this never really gets that far and therefore has largely been kind of dismissed from histories of Soviet ideas about development and aid. But there's a brief period at the end of the 50s and into the early 60s where they think they're doing this. They're sponsoring these projects. They're providing loans, for example, to a number of countries to purchase Soviet equipment and sending Soviet engineers to develop irrigation projects and fertilizer, plants that produce fertilizer and all these kinds of components of this industrial ideal, but it never quite takes off.
Well, you know, lots of ideas never really take off, but you can't really say that they're wrong about sort of the capitalist, crushing of the small farmer. I mean, looking at Trump's current subsidies that he's having to give to farmers because of his trade war, like 85% is going to large corporations.
Right. Yeah, this is a process that is absolutely ongoing. I think at this point, we as Americans are so far removed from where our food comes from that most people don't know the difference unless you're, one of these hippies, and I count myself in this, who, tries to buy whatever's fair, local, and organic, but I'm not sitting on a mint, so I can't actually do it all the time, that kind of thing.
So how did Khrushchev plan to increase corn production in the USSR, because this is not a crop that has a lot of cultural resonance outside of Ukraine, and the country was devastated by the war, didn't come back real quick. The agricultural sector had already been kind of marginal. What was he planning to do to fix it?
Yeah, so that is a big part of one of the major barriers to success, I think, that is often underestimated, in that the country has been through 50 years of tremendous upheaval. You think all the way back to the years surrounding World War I and Civil War and collectivization, and then World War II. The core agricultural areas of the country are depleted of everything that might make them more productive. And so Khrushchev is, it's a multi-pronged kind of solution to the problem, and corn is part of it, but it also is predicated on adopting new technologies, and by technologies, I mean not only things like new machines and just providing more machines, but also things like accounting practices and scientific agronomy, which of course existed under Stalin, but was pretty light on the ground. New crop breeding, on all of these kinds of things. And ultimately,
let's talk about the boogeyman of Stalinist scientific agrarian crop breeding, which would be Trofim Lysenko, because you do actually address him a little bit in your book. Would you mind explaining to our listeners who exactly he is, why he's important, and how he factors into the Corn Crusade?
Yeah, so, you know, I think the story, broadly speaking, of Lysenko is fairly well documented in the field, and I'm, you know, not trying to totally reinvent the wheel on that. You know, that he rose to prominence in the 30s. You know, his ideas have often been described as kind of neo-Lamarckian, this idea of that plants and animals can inherit acquired characteristics, that they respond and then pass along to their progeny the adaptations based on sort of immediate environmental conditions. So he claims to transform winter varieties of wheat into spring varieties, or actually I think it's the other way around, spring varieties of wheat into winter varieties by going and burying the seeds in a snowbank or something. I can't remember the exact version of this, but that's basically the idea. And the most important part of this is that whatever the validity of his ideas, which, you know, were mostly not great, he was a consummate political maneuverer and used his ability to tell powerful people, Stalin, of course, but also Khrushchev in time, what they wanted to hear. This idea that rather than having to wait for sort of mutation, random mutations, and sort of painstakingly develop new crop varieties, you could transform things more or less overnight, sounded really good to you know, people who were committed to transforming things overnight. And so he, you know, kind of ruthlessly accumulated power and destroyed his enemies, ruining their careers. In some cases, they ended up losing their lives. The famous case being an opponent of his, Nikolai Vavilov, who was a prominent sort of leader of the scientific community, who ended up in prison and dying in prison toward the end of the 30s, or maybe it was in 1940. I can't recall the exact date. But essentially, he gets to kind of set orthodoxy in biology and crop breeding throughout the post-war years under Stalin. You know, there are these scientific debates that have been documented by a number of scholars, like Ethan Pollack and so on, where Stalin helps kind of establish a single kind of orthodox line, which is, you know, described as Marxist-Leninists and materialists, et cetera, et cetera. And then whoever is opposed as, you know, bourgeois, reactionary, et cetera. And this happens in biology as well. And one of the things that Lysenko rejects is the form of, the knowledge of genetics that's required to create the most prolific, most advanced kinds of corn hybrids. And so there are researchers in the Soviet Union who have collaborated with, in the 20s and 30s, who have collaborated with Western, or especially American researchers to help develop some of these things. So when this becomes possible in the 1950s, mid-50s, to start doing this research again, they're kind of able to bring these ideas out from the shadows and are actually working with like genetic material and stuff that they have gotten from the United States back in the 30s, which is kind of fascinating. And ultimately, this is, you know, not the only reason that Lysenko loses his power, but it is the shift to allow these advanced hybrids to be the object of research and eventually, you know, a major program to produce them is kind of a sign of the times. So in 1955, Lysenko's already kind of on the ropes a little bit. And then these experts sent from the Ministry of Agriculture return from the U.S. And one of the things that they are able to do is go straight to Khrushchev and say, look, you know, the Americans are doing this thing. We have not done it, you know, parentheses unsaid, because Lysenko has blocked it. And we need to be able to do this if we're going to catch up. And he says, okay, and gives his approval for research and then considerable investments in producing these things and getting the kolkhozes and sovkhozes to use them. And so what this means for this, Lysenko and Lysenkoism, if you will, is that Khrushchev is often sort of portrayed as someone who defends Lysenko and kind of allows his power to continue, in large part because there were times when he did. Most famously, at the very end of his time in power in 1964, Khrushchev goes on this kind of ranty defense of Lysenko. But the reality is that relationship and Lysenko's power ebbs and flows considerably over the course of the decade. Khrushchev knocks him down a peg on a couple of occasions, and in particular in the year or so surrounding this adoption of these corn hybrids. So the USSR is then able to kind of rejoin the mainstream, broader kind of global mainstream in the breeding of these corn hybrids.
Well, let's talk about the other sort of elephant in the room, which is the continued collaboration with American scientists. Doesn't that sort of fly in the face of, traditional views of Cold War divisions, of, the Iron Curtain of a world divided, of people not really talking to each other or sharing ideas?
Yeah. I mean, this marks a significant departure, right? We're all familiar with, obviously McCarthyism in the U.S., but on the Soviet side, this idea of the Zhdanovshchina and this, the campaigns, the anti-cosmopolitanism, read anti-Semitic campaigns and all this kind of stuff that's try to snuff out foreign connections and foreign influence and deeply harm anyone with foreign connections. And that's essentially where this stands. In 1955, when Khrushchev is trying to really get this corn project off the ground, one of the first things they do is, pack up 10 or 12 experts from the Ministry of Agriculture and ship them off to the U.S. and Canada to figure out what they've been missing for 10 years. This is the sort of emergence of the Soviet relationship with Roswell Garst, who's kind of a well-known name, who is sort of, there's a conversation between him and Khrushchev recorded at their first meeting in the fall of 1955, where Garst is sort of perplexed at why, the Soviet experts are coming and treating things as major innovations and real revelations, even though Americans have been publishing about them in freely available publications, journals, for years. Khrushchev lets off some kind of quip about, you're going to give it to us for free, so we thought that's what it was worth. But what it really is this problem of the Cold War kind of freeze in relations and the idea of, any kind of foreign connections or knowledge that comes from a foreign source is suspect and makes anyone advocating for it themselves then suspect.
Really sort of a blip, isn't it, in sort of a long history of agricultural exchange going all the way back to the Tsarist period, right?
Yeah. It taps into a deeper deeper strain of connection. So, yeah, it's that the post-war, the 46 to 53, 54 period is the outlier. And there's a certain amount of this closing off, in the years of the terror as well in the 30s. But these connections are deep in the 20s. They go back to, certainly to the 19th century. There are American travelers who go to the Soviet or to the Russian Empire, sort of trying to learn what they can about what's going on, and also vice versa. People bringing expert knowledge, American companies going and setting up factories to produce machines in the Russian Empire, all these kinds of things. The closing off is really the outlier, and the relative openness to new ideas that comes in the mid-50s is more in line with the norm. And I think it's quite telling that the renewal of exchanges in a whole range of formal exchanges of ideas and delegations emerges from the sort of atmosphere around a summit meeting of the four powers in Geneva in the summer of 55. And among the first couple of exchanges are around agriculture. It's like agriculture and then a bunch of Komsomol journalists, and I think maybe a ballet company fairly quickly. But, agriculture is like top of the list.
And so, you know, you mentioned a lot of these American technologies and methodologies that they take to try and improve corn. You've mentioned, you know, these hybrids, increased technology. Are there other things that they take?
Yeah. So the hybrids are a big one. You know, a broader range of machines that the Soviet Union didn't have. And then these experts go to the U.S. in the mid-50s, and they look around and, you know, they've adopted and developed all these things that save labor. And it's really at this point that for the first time they realize that, you know, sort of the broad sort of use of labor, manual labor in agriculture is not going to work in the long run, because they're starting to realize that urbanization and people are sort of fleeing from the farms in search of better livings in cities and in sort of industrial employment and this kind of thing. And so they have to kind of jump on board with this as well. But as I mentioned before, you know, the idea of technology also encompasses things like, you know, bookkeeping and accounting for production costs, which is something that Stalin simply had not allowed to be done by the kolkhozes since their establishment. So that by 53, they literally have no even way to account for what it costs to produce, you know, a ton of corn or a ton of pork or whatever it is. And they have to actually start reforming all of these systems, including the labor day system, to make this possible.
Do you want to explain to our listeners what exactly you mean by labor day? Because it's not an actual day, which is confusing.
Yeah, it's a measure of labor rather than a measure of time. It's a, in theory, standardized, in practice, extremely subjective measurement of how much labor a member of the kolkhoz has done in the course of the day. And what it means is that at the end of the year, you get to add up all the labor days that you've accumulated, and that determines what share of the sort of collective earnings goes to you. Now, what this really means in the Stalin era is that after the kolkhoz has paid all of its many debts and dues and taxes and forced procurements and stuff, you're getting, you know, a fractional share of the leftovers at the end. And so the kolkhoznik, the peasant workers, don't, you know, they quite rightly see this as essentially forced labor, and they are not really enthusiastic about it. And so Khrushchev, and the other thing is that it varies, what that is worth varies from year to year, from kolkhoz to kolkhoz, let alone from region to region. And what they realize is that if we're going to begin to calculate what something costs and therefore make some determinations about, you know, on this farm or in this region, it's more efficient to produce these things and not those things, they have to be able to standardize that. And so they start moving away from this, you know, proportion of a share of the leftovers at the end of the year to a more stable wage model that pays a kind of basic wage and then allows for some leeway in terms of bonuses for anything you might produce above and beyond the expected.
Well, that's one of the big things about the kolkhoz system, though, I guess, that maybe not everyone listening would know, is that people didn't get paid cash. I mean, you're talking about these labor days. Very few of them were paid entirely in cash. Even more than half were paid entirely in kind. So in grain and chickens and in whatever.
Potatoes.
Yeah, a lot of grain, a lot of potatoes, not actually a lot of chickens. Although, interestingly, I have to say, I do have a lot of collective farm chairmen in Kirov who get in a lot of trouble for distributing stuff, particularly in years of famine, before they pay the government. So they do actually ignore the government on occasion.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
But yeah, I mean, this is a problem, is that they have no money to buy goods like kerosene or shoes or clothing or even pay taxes.
Right. And so one of the things that Khrushchev is doing in parallel with this adoption of these kind of technological fixes that travel under the name of industrial agriculture. And this is what I'm really trying to get at with this idea of rural modernization, is that they're trying to increase efficiency to make up for the fact that people are leaving, and to kind of break that cycle, to help inject money into this system so that people can buy the consumer goods they need and pay their taxes in cash and whatever else. And so Khrushchev moves gradually, somewhat piecemeal, at times much faster than planned. You know, the classic sort of problems with implementing policy is, you know, we're going to do this over 5 years, and then everyone is forced to do it in one. You end up with chaos. To move from that system of labor days to a system of cash wages. They're not all doing it by the end of 1964, but the difference is pretty profound. And certainly by the end of the 60s, they've pretty much all moved to this cash system. Or at the very least, when they do pay them in kind, it is then calculated as a cash equivalent. And so sort of bringing the kolkhozniks into this cash economy is another element of, you know, what Khrushchev is trying to do, because ultimately they believe that this is a better incentive than the kind of mix of out-and-out coercion and, you know, the exhortations of, you know, work harder so we can build socialism or whatever the case may be, or we can support the war effort, or, you know, depending on the time and place.
Well, you talk a lot about labor shortage, and, you know, you talk mostly about sort of the push-pull of, you know, the cities versus the countryside where you have better opportunities and stuff. But I'm sure the war absolutely devastated the working population. I mean, just the demographic losses means that, you know, any excess population they ever did have is already gone. So how does Khrushchev try and make up for the fact that you have these very serious labor shortages and you don't really have the mechanization to, you know, make up for it? I mean, you talk about the Komsomol in particular and students.
Yeah, part of it is that there are several things. Part of it is to increase the mechanization to try to make up for it. Part of it is to try to slow the out-migration of people. But also part of it is to try to kind of get the most out of the people that are there. So things like the Komsomol are an important element of this. But I think for a long time, people looked at the kind of mobilizational tactics that this involved and assumed that that was the sum total of what Khrushchev was trying to do. That, you know, these are the kind of great campaigns that are very much in a Stalinist vein. This is the Virgin Lands campaign. We're going to mobilize 600,000 Komsomols and dump them out in Kazakhstan to start, you know, set up these farms. You know, isn't this great heroic undertaking? We're going to praise them in all this propaganda. And so there's an element of that, but it's also coupled with the increase of wages and other kind of material incentives and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, though, you talk more about short-term socialist competitions and particularly sending students on summer holiday or after graduation as a way to sort of instill work effort.
Yeah, so there is an element of that, certainly. The idea, I think, is broadly an appeal to youth as this kind of the right word has escaped me here, but essentially as an anti-conservative kind of force, right? That the idea of Khrushchev and his kind of advisors is that corn is a great idea, and the reason why it's not working as well as they hope is that there are these conservative forces in, you know, regional leadership and, you know, kolkhoz chairmen and these kinds of things that are kind of dragging their feet about it. They're kind of sabotaging the effort. And so the idea is to use, you know, the Komsomol and these Komsomol socialist competitions to kind of try to break through. And so they use the Komsomol hierarchy, which sort of helpfully in this period is rapidly expanding its reach in rural areas in a way that it didn't extend into down to the level of farms and stuff as much under Stalin.
Well, because there was always Komsomol, but they didn't really do a whole lot.
Yeah. And so this idea that you know, we can, and they did, they set up these annual competitions and they ran them regularly every year. And the kind of winning, you know, they're usually done by kind of work team level kind of thing. And then for regions as well, you know, that you could win a prize and there was, you know, a certain amount of prestige involved as well. And that, you know, these are pretty large scale. There are some instances where as much as half of the corn being grown in a region, one particular case of countrywide, is being done by these Komsomol groups, which are made up typically of, you know, whatever Komsomol members are there, but also anyone of Komsomol age who's doing this work is kind of drafted into the team as well. And so it's very much in this kind of mobilizational, you know, we'll encourage people to do this by, you know, telling them that they're working to build communism, offering them medals and trophies and these kinds of things. But there were also some actual kind of material incentives. You could win, you know, a small cash prize, or, you know, for young people growing up in a village somewhere, you know, winning some kind of consumer good could be a really big deal. You know, if you were really outstanding, you could win, you know, a radio set or pocket or a wristwatch or, you know, any number of these kinds of things, or win some kind of sort of bigger thing for your local Komsomol organization, that kind of thing. So there are kind of material incentives as well.
Well, and I got the impression a lot of students actually use this as sort of like a country holiday with their friends. You know, they did work in the fields, but they also went swimming, they flirted with girls or boys, they got drunk together.
There's a certain element of that too. And I think they're kind of parallel and related streams, but they are, I think, distinct. You know, I document these kinds of attempts to integrate this kind of work into the school program. And often, you know, this is then dealing with sort of school-aged kids up into high school, whereas the broader kind of Komsomol effort could extend to people well into their 20s, right? In this period, they're defining youth, quote-unquote, Komsomol-aged people up to, I believe, age 27, whereas there are these kind of school groups which are operating on their own, distinct from the kind of rank-and-file members of the Jojos, and yet, yeah, they're very much trying to ingrain this idea of, you know, doing an honest day's labor, and, you know, as that chapter in particular documents, you know, sometimes they are using it as time to kind of, you know, be kids, to, you know, fluff off work and go swimming, get into various kinds of trouble. But the broad idea is that this is instilling a work ethic, and as such, very much ties into Khrushchev's broader educational reforms of the late 50s, in which he tried to kind of de-emphasize the kinds of classical kind of elements of the Stalinist education system, where things were geared toward formal book, you know, classroom, with the idea that you were preparing students for higher education by forcing everyone, including those who were headed for higher education, into some kind of manual labor for a certain defined period. The idea that if you hadn't done this kind of manual labor, you would be disconnected, you wouldn't appreciate, you know, the importance of the socialist project or to be, you know, sort of a member of this society.
Well, I think this goes back to the old Bolshevik tradition of valuing people that come off the factory floor.
Yeah. I think Khrushchev is very much...
well, he did come off the factory floor.
He's of that generation, right? That's literally what he did. So yeah, I think that's an element of it, certainly. But by the same token, it's representative of the profound changes in Soviet society, in that, you know, the 30s and 40s created this urban, technological, educated society in which, you know, engineers and doctors and professors are, there's a profusion of all these kind of white collar careers, and now their kids are coming of age, and there's this fear that they won't appreciate how, you know, what that means, right? There's this fear that, you know, the son of a professor is going to expect to kind of waltz through and into higher education without ever really dirtying their hands, and that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of reminded me of anti-millennial rants you hear from baby boomers now in some ways.
Yeah. And you sort of wonder, you know, perhaps there's something, I hate to speculate or even, you know, whether there is such a thing as human nature per se, but there does seem to be something kind of trans-historical about older people, you know, shaking their fists and saying, kids these days.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of problems did Khrushchev run into in the implementation of his corn policies? I mean, certainly we've talked about the lack of labor, but the lack of technology and manufacturing capabilities was something that compounded this lack of labor, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That he is very adamant that the technology is an important part of this. Yet I think this really shows the limitations of the power of Khrushchev or any other, you know, individual leader to really force through some kind of program if it didn't have the buy-in of the bureaucracy. You know, there are these instances where he goes to great lengths to put in a course correction to get the manufacturing bureaucracies and stuff to start producing harvesters and tractors and, you know, sort of the appropriate stuff that the farms need. And they do it for a brief time. And then, you know, 3 years later, they quietly go to the, you know, transition those factories to producing something else. So, you know, they painstakingly build up production of these harvesters and tractors and things up through the end of the 50s. And then suddenly, for no real understandable reason, the production just falls off a cliff. So they're facing shortages of this machinery just at the time when Khrushchev is really pushing corn planting to new heights in the early 60s.
Although in fairness to a lot of these people, if I recall, he did something like increase production norms from like a couple hundred to several thousand in a year. And you're like, you know, even if they wanted to make this, they don't have the resources or the tooled up factories to do this, right?
Yeah. There's a certain element of sort of demanding the impossible. But then, you know, they kind of keep at it for a couple of years to the point where it becomes somewhat more expected. I think it's indicative of sort of a bigger set of problems with the way this kind of broader economic management functions, the above and beyond agriculture, that is perhaps a little above my pay grade, but there are, you know, there's some scholarship out there on the ways that this works. And so there is a certain amount of asking the impossible, but also then these kinds of problems with incentives. It's a lot easier to produce things that are malfunctioning, but you do it quickly to meet your plan than it is to actually kind of create, you know, to manufacture stuff that works, and you know, all the kind of documented problems.
Well, let's talk about that a bit, the intransigent bureaucracy, because we mentioned it briefly with the Komsomol, that they were supposed to sort of kickstart these older people moving. And this has certainly been a problem that goes back to, you know, the Tsarist period. Stalin deals with it. The Russian bureaucracy just does not do change, does it?
Yeah. I'm hesitant to make kind of grand pronouncements on that, because I think there's a danger in ascribing a certain kind of like ahistorical permanence to like, oh, Russians and bureaucracy. And yet there is a certain, you know, there are certain continuities. And I think, you know, on some level, it's it is both a deep, long-running problem, but I think it's also worth, you know, pointing out that Khrushchev abandons repression on the level of the Stalin era, right? No one, sorry, there's a helicopter going by outside, if you, and it's what it is. You know, Stalin abandons this, Khrushchev abandons Stalin's practice, right? If you really managed to flub up your planned productions, you could end up in a labor camp or worse. That kind of stuff just doesn't happen under Khrushchev for the most part. I mean, the worst that could happen is you get fired and you move on to some other job because there's such a shortage of people with any kind
of skills. Stalin killing bureaucrats didn't actually fix the problem.
Right, no.
I mean, it got rid of that bureaucrat, but it didn't fix the brokenness of the overall system.
Right, and so, you know, certainly not killing bureaucrats is not necessarily going to change it. And so Khrushchev's response is one of the things that's often, you know, sort of earns him the most derision is the like constant tinkering with the administrative apparatus. And I think it's worth saying that kind of there was a consensus among the quote-unquote collective leadership in the early years after Stalin's death that something needed to be done about this, that these ministries, especially the kinds of centralized ministries based in Moscow, you know, I was always sort of perpetually amazed at the profusion of, you know, ministry of this kind of machine building and ministry of that kind of machine building and the ways in which they became these kind of silos and duplicated functions and all of these things that led to all kinds of inefficiencies. So the initial reorganizations that try to decentralize some of this stuff are certainly backed by Khrushchev, but not his idea alone. And as they, you know, kind of muddle through the rest of the decade, certainly some of the reorganizations are Khrushchev's and are less popular. You know, again, his idea of splitting the party is kind of the peak of this. But there's always his attempt to, you know, there's a certain amount of carrot and stick efforts to force them to be more responsive, be more responsible for what it is that they're trying to do. And yet there is this kind of inertia that just seems to defy whatever efforts.
Could you maybe explain the scope of that problem? Because I think for a lot of people who are not really into the profession, you know, you sort of expect that the leader gives the order and then stuff happens, but that's really not how the Soviet system worked at all, was it?
Yeah, it's not how a lot of people imagined the system worked, but it doesn't take very long digging in the archives to realize that it's much more chaotic. And in part, you know, this is the nature of any bureaucracy. You know, it's sort of a game of telephone on some level, right? In that, you know, you start off with a clearly formulated policy directive or objective and set of directives on how to achieve it. And then as this is sort of divided up into bits and pieces and sort of spread throughout the system, it loses its focus. But there's also, you know, all kinds of problems that are peculiar to this time and place. And that one, you have a profusion of kind of overlapping areas of responsibility, right? One of the things that's happening under Khrushchev is that Khrushchev kind of leads a reassertion of the Communist Party as a vehicle for managing the economy, a role that it had at various points in the past, but that Stalin during the war and especially the post-war period had largely snuffed out, right? You have this kind of balancing act between the role of the government and the role of the Communist Party, and it had tipped quite profoundly in the direction of the government up to 1953, and then there's this kind of counterbalancing that brings the party back in. And so, in theory, the party and the government are supposed to work side by side at all levels. The reality is much more chaotic. But they're also then just competing incentives, right? One of the things is that because everything, at least in theory, comes from Moscow and kind of filters down from the top, there are often too many competing priorities for a region and its leadership, or a particular enterprise and its management, to actually do everything. And so they had to start kind of making choices about what to prioritize and what to de-emphasize. There's sort of an incentive to follow whatever, follow the orders that seem like the most important and then kind of forget the rest. There's a tendency, right, that's very well established under Stalin of the kind of, this is the campaign for today. This is what we're focusing on now. It's, increasing production of whatever, commodity threefold in the next year, or, fulfilling the five-year plan in 4 years, or whatever it is. And so to see any given policy initiative as a short-term campaign for show, and then, next week or next month or next year, we'll be on to something else and we can safely abandon that. And so there's a lot of evidence, all of it kind of most of it circumstantial and sort of fragmented, that this is essentially how most officials in various ministries and local government and party organizations interpreted Khrushchev's agricultural policies, including corn, at the beginning, especially, is, this is a campaign for a year. We'll do this. It's a big kind of propaganda thing, and then we'll quietly drop it and move on to the next thing. And it took quite a while for Khrushchev to kind of convince them that he meant business. Yeah, it's a big, complicated problem, and the fact of the matter is that no Soviet leader ever solved this problem. These are the problems, having evolved over the decades. These are some of the same problems that are facing Gorbachev when he comes to office in 20 years later in the 80s.
Well, let's go beyond these problems of just sort of chaos and, into the actual, working against Khrushchev, because there was some of that. And you particularly talk about sort of the falsification of data and people actually directly ignoring or countermanding his orders. And let's start with the falsification of data, and in particular, the case you mentioned in Ryazan, because that is absolutely fascinating how much they lie.
Yeah. So the Ryazan scandal is a pretty well-known one. It's commonly sort of part of the story in the literature of the Khrushchev period, in which the party boss of Ryazan, which is this kind of agricultural region south of Moscow, southeast of Moscow, in 1 year they increase, I believe it's 1 year in 58, they increase milk production like 200%. Maybe that's in 59. And then the following year, they are going to fulfill their meat procurement plan three times, I believe. And this becomes just kind of the propaganda circus, right? Everything in Pravda and all the newspapers is all about the heroic efforts of the Ryazaners to help raise living standards and compete with the U.S. Right? This is the era of overtake and catch up to and surpass the United States in these areas of production. And what they're really doing is, scouring the countryside and buying up every animal they can find. They're going to neighboring regions and buying up every animal they can find. There are instances of, so they go through and they basically give every person like a quota of however much they're supposed to come up with. And if they don't have a cow to slaughter or something, there are people who go and buy meat in the shop and then go back and turn it in as their own production. And, all these kinds of crazy, counterproductive schemes to create this appearance. And, this is set up as a model And so others then in turn have to kind of promise the impossible and somehow deliver. And so, you know, in a way, the Riazan story is kind of known. And one of the things I want to show in this is the final chapter of the book is that, and this is happening, you know, to varying degrees on varying scales throughout the country. And that corn kind of plays a small role in this, in that if you're going to claim that you've increased your farm's production of beef threefold in a year, you also have to, in theory, quote unquote, have, you know, raised the crops to feed them. And so they're inflating their corn harvests as well. Within a year or two, all of this fraud and deceit becomes too, the evidence of it becomes sort of too prominent, too obvious to ignore. There are a series of scandals. Lariana, the party leader in Riazan, actually commits suicide. So having been sort of feted as this you know, sort of leader who's living out the very best of, you know, who's creating the kind of agricultural revolution that Khrushchev is craving, he ends up disgraced. And this deeply damages Khrushchev's credibility as well.
If I recall, I don't know that it was your book. It may have been one of your footnotes that I tracked down. I do believe he actually had a huge funeral, though, that he was well-liked, that people were actually very sad that he died. And this was set in contrast to a similar scandal in Kirov, where the party boss was actually a jerk, a horrible, horrible, nasty human being, and people were more than happy to throw him under the bus. So, you know, some of these people who did bad things were still actually liked and respected.
And that kind of taps into, you know, some of the work that Oleg Klevnyuk and others have done about sort of trying to develop kind of a classification system for these different kind of regional party organizations. So some of them, you know, kind of have these real tight-knit kind of organizations. And so they're able to basically conspire to do these various, you know, to do this kind of fraud and stuff. And they have enough trust in each other to keep it hidden to some greater or lesser degree. And then there are other models that are much more conflicted, or, you know, a party boss who doesn't have the power to kind of enforce this, like the guy in Kirov.
Well, and this has been a problem for quite some time. I mean, I look at stuff like flax campaigns in the 1930s, and they were doing things like going around and stealing the flax out of people's blankets to meet the quotas.
This does not surprise me. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
But I think it points out that the system is very broken and that the quotas tend to be the main focus. No one really cares how you get there. And that once you have these massively inflated quotas, you have no idea how to govern, because none of the data you're trying to govern the country with is actually real.
Right, exactly. And so it there's a kind of a chicken or the egg problem here. It's so tightly bound together, you don't know. They don't quite have any way to kind of get out of that cycle. This is the kind of immovable object that Khrushchev keeps running into with all of these bureaucratic reorganizations and attempts to, you know, browbeat, shame, incentivize, whatever else he can into getting them to work effectively and efficiently, because no one really knows what that looks like, because they've, you know, existed in this kind of system for so long.
Well, you also, though, talk about, in particular in the Baltic republics, Lithuania, people actually countermanding or directly ignoring Khrushchev's orders, possibly in part because the Baltics were a recent addition to the USSR and they weren't super happy about it. But what exactly was going on there?
So the story in Lithuania is slightly different in that rather than sort of making sort of outlandish claims to how much they were producing, it was about crop rotations and what they were planting. Khrushchev kept badgering them to plant more corn, and the sort of experts in agronomy said, you know, well, this isn't going to work. We should be doing sort of our traditional approach of pastures and all this stuff. And so the political leadership, up to and including the first secretary, essentially form a a conspiracy to basically falsify all the documentation that says, oh yeah, we've planted it, we've plowed up all these pastures, we're planting corn, we're doing, you know, we've taken the kritika from Khrushchev, and we're implementing the changes now. And they just kind of keep stringing them along this way for several years. And then once Khrushchev falls, there are these brief moments where the kind of mask falls and the party leader kind of gleefully claims, see, we fooled them. You know, we pulled the wool over their eyes. And my argument here is that, you know, in a way, this fits into the same kind of model of what's happening in a place like Ryazan in terms of, you know, having a local organization that is fairly tight-knit and is able to kind of control what information gets out, but that it's actually successful, right? Eventually, Ryazan sort of breaks down. People start writing letters to Moscow, to Khrushchev, saying, whoa, there's something very wrong here. Whereas in Lithuania, as best, it's fairly clear that Khrushchev kind of figures out something is up, but no one ever sort of lays it bare, and they get away with it. And my suggestion is that there's an added element of kind of national pride or national identity tied up in this, that, the leader of the Lithuanian Republic is Lithuanian, and a good chunk of the party hierarchy is as well. And so they have this kind of extra element of solidarity that helps them keep it quiet. So they cut out, broadly speaking, in this period, I mean, places like the Baltic Republics, the first secretary is a member of the titular nationality, a Lithuanian in this case, and then the second secretary will be a Russian. And they seem to have basically just kind of cut him out sort of kept up a front to keep him in the dark. I think it raises this same question about, you know, to what degree can we really see the Soviet Union as governed from Moscow? Moscow sets formal policies, but in the end, the regions are often so far and have enough kind of leeway to strike out on their own to greater or lesser degrees as circumstances dictate.
So would you say Khrushchev's corn policies are the abject failure that most historians think they are, or were they fairly successful?
Somewhere in between. Successful is probably a bridge too far. But I think it's telling that when Khrushchev falls in 1964, it's not as if corn goes away. Soviet farms continued to plant it, and without the kind of pressure from above to do so, all of the kind of propaganda and all of the agitation that goes around it, which is immense. I don't think I can quite convey how much of this is just sort of pouring out all the time in posters and newspapers and magazines and journals and Khrushchev's speeches, which are endless.
And cartoons of singing corn.
And cartoons of singing corn and, you know, yeah, everything. All that dries up instantly. And yet, the amount of corn that Soviet farms are planting stabilizes at a level that's lower than the peak under Khrushchev, but, 5 or 6 or 7 times higher than it was prior to Khrushchev. So clearly, something has changed. They're planting on the order of 20 million hectares of corn per year, which is a lot. it's a relatively small fraction of the total area, but much more than was the case 10 years before at the end of the Stalin era. And so basically it works on small scales in certain areas, where the conditions are right, where the farms have the labor, the technology, the knowledge to kind of do what needs to be done and are willing to do it. And all those things don't come together very often, but when they do, they actually achieve some successes. And so the problem is always that there's a kind of a confirmation bias in that Khrushchev kind of uses these to then browbeat everyone else that says, well, you know, the farm next door to yours has corn yields that are three times as high. What are you doing wrong? Now, what may be the case is, you know, an absence of the right labor supply, the right machines, the right seeds, whatever it is. And that often kind of gets lost. But there are enough successes in enough places to make it kind of work. and that basically what keeps it from being what Khrushchev hopes is a very complicated and complex set of causes rather than one or two simple ones. And for a long time, the kind of consensus among scholars and certainly the popular consensus was a very simple one. This is an unfamiliar crop. It's unsuited to the climate. You know, open and shut. And what I want to show is that climate and unfamiliarity account for some part of this. But what we really have is a much more complicated and interesting story about bureaucracy, technology, reform and responses to reform and sort of dragging feet. But that there are also significant successes that are, you know, if not down to corn precisely, are part of this larger program that Khrushchev is after, this idea of industrial agriculture, that, you know, by the end of his 10 years, Soviet agriculture looks profoundly different in terms of the technologies they're using, not just machines, but things like accounting and the wage labor and the application of genetics and agronomy and all these things that, while they weren't totally absent in 1953, were so sparse on the ground that the changes that Khrushchev made make a significant difference, even if it never lives up to his very, very ambitious expectations.
Well, thank you for your time and your interview. I think we've probably taken pretty much a lot of your time. just one last question. Is there anything that you're working on now that you'd like to tell us about, a next project, or are you taking a break?
I've had something kind of simmering on the back burner to kind of pick up some of the threads of this project, but to move in a couple of new directions. So one of the sort of moments of the 1970s and the era of detente that is fairly well known is that the Soviet Union starts to import grain on a large scale. Basically what they're doing is, this is the era when they're beginning to make significant earnings of hard currency, exporting petroleum, oil, mostly natural gas, and to try to bridge the gap left by lagging Soviet agricultural productivity, they go to the U.S., to Canada, elsewhere, and start buying up grain on a pretty large scale, beginning kind of at the height of detente, 72, 73. And on the one hand, this is denounced by critics and anti-communists in the U.S. and elsewhere, as the quote-unquote great grain robbery, this idea that this is grain that's being subsidized by, in the American case, the American taxpayer, and then being sold off at cut rate prices to the Soviet Union to keep them afloat. And so basically the project that I want to do is kind of use this as an entree into understanding Soviet Union is how the leaders are understanding food and agriculture, and it intersects with oil and gas in some really interesting ways. So the origin of this is I started digging in the files about these grain deals, and in the papers of the Ministry of Agriculture there are these folders with, you know, side by side in the folders are documents about these negotiations around buying grain, and then there are all of these Western oil company executives popping up, and they're saying, you know, you have these massive oil reserves. We, you know, and they're Americans in many cases. You know, in the U.S., we've kind of reached our peak oil production. We're worried about energy. We want to help you secure loans, and we'll provide the equipment. We want to, you know, help you exploit and export this oil and natural gas. And so there's this like kind of nexus of, and the other side of this, of course, is that food production, grain production under in a system of industrial agriculture like you find in the U.S. and Canada is awash in a sea of petroleum. It's in the fuel for tractors, it's in the pesticides and other chemicals that go into this, it's in the energy that goes into producing the fertilizer, it's everywhere. And so there's this kind of link between the two that I think is really worth exploring for the ways that it sees the Soviet Union in a global light and hopefully sheds light both on the larger global situation, but also on the way of
the 70s. It does sound interesting. Well, thank you for your time and doing this interview. It's been great having you.
Thank you for having me. This has been